From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and we'll start this hour with the cold gripping much of the country. Wind chills in parts of Michigan are forecast to hit minus 35 this afternoon, and residents of the state are being asked to turn their thermostats down to conserve natural gas. Here's what Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer said in an address last night.
I'm coming to you to ask for your help. Due to this extremely cold weather and extremely high demand for natural gas and a facility incident, Consumers Energy has asked that everyone in the Lower Peninsula turn our thermostats down to 65 degrees or less.
That utility company, Consumers Energy, supplies natural gas and electricity to more than half of the state's residents. At their request, General Motors has halted production at 11 plants around Michigan to conserve energy. Joining us now from Ann Arbor is Tracy Samilton. She covers energy and transportation for Michigan Radio. Hi, Tracy.
Hello.
And Governor Whitmer mentioned that facility incident. That was a fire yesterday at a Consumer Energy gas compressor station in a Detroit suburb. How severely did that impact the utility?
It was pretty bad. That compressor station that had the fire breakout provides the natural gas flow to about 60% of Consumers Energy customers. So it was a really serious incident.
And hours after the appeal last night from the governor, people in Michigan received an emergency alert on their phones asking them to lower their thermostats. Does that mean that people weren't responding to the governor's request, or they just wanted to make sure everybody got the message?
Well, there was press releases going out during the course of the day where Consumers Energy and the Michigan Public Service Commission were asking people to take action and turn down their thermostats. It's really, really cold.
Yeah.
and they just weren't getting the response. From what I'm told, they weren't getting the response from residents that they needed to get to make sure that the natural gas flow wasn't shut down.
What about electricity? Are people being asked to conserve electricity as well?
Yeah, they are being asked to conserve electricity for a reason related to the cold, but it has more to do with the electric grid. So what's happening in our region, which is run by a grid operator called MISO. MISO has asked utilities in Michigan and other Midwest states to tell customers, please, you know, turn down your thermostats because there's a very high demand for electricity as well as natural gas, and we want to make sure that everything is okay. So turn your thermostats down.
Is it possible that Consumer Energy will stop service to some customers?
Well, they already have stopped service to a lot of large commercial users because they have contracts with these companies where they agree to shut down in an emergency. So General Motors and Ford and Fiat Chrysler and Hemlock Semiconductor and Dow, a lot of these facilities, some big university campuses turned down the heat. They have already responded. And they're hoping that residents will respond enough so that they don't have to do some kind of triage where they pick a city where, you know, there's very few nursing homes and hospitals and say, sorry, we got to cut you off.
And what about the industry part of this, the auto industry halting operations? This is Patty Pope, president and CEO of Consumers Energy, speaking yesterday.
I want to personally thank all of our large business customers, companies like General Motors, Chrysler, Fiat, Ford, Gerdau, and many, many countless others for interrupting their production schedules tonight, tomorrow, and Friday as a result of our system capability.
What has been the impact of this on automakers in Michigan?
Well, it's a lot of money out of their pocket. When you have to shut down a factory, it can be upwards of $1 million you've lost. So it's a significant thing that they are experiencing, especially the automakers where they have to shut down the actual assembly lines.
Is this something that people were talking about before yesterday, the idea that this cold could cause a real problem when it comes to natural gas, or was this kind of out of the blue?
You know, I think this was a perfect storm that we hadn't experienced yet. It's certainly going to be a learning experience for MISO and the state. Governor Whitmer has already asked for an investigation. You know, when you have one facility that is responsible for keeping the gas going to so many people, Consumers Energy had enough gas. There was no question. They had enough gas. But the problem was They lost the ability to actually get it to people because of that fire, which was something they probably did not plan for.
Finally, Tracy, is anybody out on the roads today in Michigan, or is it too cold?
Well, my commute is so easy right now because people are hunkering down at home and just staying home. Schools are closed. A lot of businesses are closed. And you just have to sort of not take a real deep breath on your way from your front door to your car.
And bundle up.
Yeah,
Tracy
exactly.
Samuelton, energy and transportation reporter at Michigan Radio, joining us from Ann Arbor. Tracy, thanks.
My pleasure.
Well, let's turn now to a big deadline today in the ongoing battle over the Colorado River. Now, the river provides water to 40 million people in 7 states, but it's been impacted by drought and overuse. And if states can't agree on a plan for how to reduce water usage by the end of this day, the federal government will take over and make those decisions, which all has huge implications for cities and farmers in the Southwest. Joining us now, Professor Robert Glennon, Regents Professor at the University of Arizona, author of Unquenchable, America's Water Crisis and What to Do About It. Professor, welcome.
Good to be with you.
And we've talked on the program before about this river and how it's seen drought, years of overuse. We've seen pictures, for instance, Lake Mead in Arizona on the Colorado River at historic lows. We've talked to people living along the river about how neighbors up above them are using more than their share. I mean, it's become quite contentious. So just remind us, give us the thumbnail, what the problem is, why this plan is necessary.
Well, it starts really, Robin, in 2007 when the 7 basin states actually agreed to something. Most of the 20th century, they weren't agreeing to much of anything. And what they agreed to do was to abide by certain criteria for when they would each take less than they are entitled to by the legal rules. These so-called shortage criteria governed all the states. And the criteria become effective if the level in Lake Mead drops below various elevations above sea level. And the first one, Robin, is 1075. Mm. And wouldn't you know it, but this drought is pushing that level closer and closer and closer. Mm. And if that happens, there'll be serious consequences, especially for Arizona and Nevada.
Right, if it gets to that elevation. So why have, you mentioned states who signed on to this plan, but why have California and Arizona not signed on?
Well, I think the interests, particularly the farmers in both states, who would be the first ones cut, are pressing them and their allies in the legislatures and in the political branch to try and keep them in a better position than they would otherwise be in. Mm-hmm. And some of it is posturing, some of it is real. The problem is that this is the 19th year of drought, and no one knows whether it's the 19th year of a 19-year drought or the 19th year of a 50 or 70-year drought.
Right.
And much turns on that that distinction. And the farmers they've been caught up in this. No one expected in 2007 that the level in Lake Mead would drop from 100% full to less than half full.
And as you said, it's still going down. And if it gets down to that certain elevation, this plan has to kick in, but everybody has to sign on it by the end of today, or the federal government takes over. Just your thoughts about the federal government taking over.
Well, that would be a very bad thing for several of the states, including Arizona and California. One of the problems, Robin, is that the first level may be hit soon, but once the lake starts dropping, it will drop faster and faster as the level goes down. Mm. For the simple reason that the surface of the lake when the reservoir is full is much bigger in diameter.
Right.
Think about these two reservoirs. They're both dams that were built in canyons, and of course the bottom of the canyon is very narrow. So as the reservoirs start to go down, it will accelerate how quickly the second and third criteria will trigger in.
Now, look, the Colorado River supplies water to people in San Diego, Los Angeles, all along the waterway in 7 states. I mean, how concerned are people? You live there. I mean, is this the talk?
Oh, this is very much the talk, yes, completely. Mm-hmm. And it's in Arizona's case, they're the only state that requires the legislature to sign on to the agreement. In other states, the administrative agencies that govern water have been able to sign on. But I think today you're going to see this happen because if it doesn't happen, then the Commissioner of Reclamation, Brenda Berman, has announced that she will invite the states to submit their own plans for what to do, but she will not be governed by that. And she will not be governed by the plans unless all seven states agree. It's very troublesome.
Yeah, we've had our eye on the cold in the Midwest, but we also want to make sure we keep an eye on this water/drought problem in your area. Professor Robert Glennon, Regents Professor at the University of Arizona, his book, Unquenchable: America's Water Crisis and What to Do About It. And we've been talking about something that seven states have to do today. Professor Glennon, thanks so much.
A pleasure to chat with you, Robin.
In 1952, Ernest Hemingway published The Old Man and the Sea, the story of the down-on-his-luck Cuban fisherman Santiago and his desperate attempt to catch a marlin after 85 days without one. It won the Pulitzer, helped Hemingway win the Nobel a few years later. Of Old Man and the Sea, Faulkner wrote, his best. Time may show it to be the single best piece of any of us. Well, in 1958, it was made into a John Sturges film starring Spencer Tracy. In this scene, Tracy, as Santiago, spools out a line with bait to the marlin taunting him below.
Eat them, fish. Eat them. Please eat them. How fresh they are. And you down deep in that cold water in the dark.
Well, Hemingway hated the movie, as he told his friend, the playwright A.E. Hotchner. Years before, Hemingway had handed Hotchner some papers and asked him to take a look at what turned out to be Old Man and the Sea. As they left the movie theater, Hemingway turned to Hotch, as he called him, and said, well, maybe one day you can do better. That was 61 years ago. A.E. Hotchner is now 101. His stage version of The Old Man and the Sea will open at the Pittsburgh Playhouse tomorrow in partnership with RWS Production. And A.E. Hotchner joins us now from his home in Connecticut. You say I can call you Hotch, just like Hemingway did?
That's right. Very glad to be with you.
Well, we're so thrilled to speak with you. Also author, by the way, of several biographies of Hemingway. And also joining us from Pittsburgh, A.E.'s son, Tim. Tim, you collaborated on this adaptation. Welcome to you as well.
Thanks so much. Happy to be here.
And Hotch, again, I can't get used to calling you the same thing Hemingway did, but when he handed you those papers, the manuscript had just been typed up by his wife. What did you think when you read it?
Well, we had just had dinner, and I had gone into my guest house, and he came in with a sheaf of typewritten manuscript in his hand, and he said, I just finished this. Mary typed it up, and would you like to take a look at it? I said, sure, leave it. Mm-hmm. And I must say, I was transported. Imagine for the first time seeing these wrinkled up pages and reading what would become an epic of American literature. Mm-hmm. A few weeks later, he called and said, Life magazine wants to publish it in one issue. But I wonder if I should save it to do a bigger book about the sea. And I said, well, you told me one of the golden rules of freelancing is if you write something and they want to publish it, grab the money and run. So he did. And let's go about 5 years later. And he's come to New York for the World Series, but Old Man and the Sea has just been made into a movie with Spencer Tracy. And we're walking down Park Avenue, and he said, why don't we go and take a look at it, which we did. And we lasted about 10 or 12 minutes, and he turned to me and said, ready to go? And I said, sure. So we left, and he said, you know, you write something, and you like it, and over the years, it does well. And then they do this to it. It's like pissing in your father's beer.
Oh, geez, he did.
So, well, Ernest was rather direct, and he said, maybe someday you'll take a shot at it. So it took me a long time. I wrote my biography of him, Papa Hemingway. I did that 5 years after he died. But over the years, I kept thinking about his saying, why don't you take a shot at it? And finally, I decided I would. And it took me 4 or 5 years to get the version that I liked. And I brought my son into it. And we have high hopes.
Well, we spent about 2 months on it before rehearsals, really kind of reimagining the story because, you know, it's such a difficult one to put on the stage. Obviously, it works beautifully as a book.
Yeah.
And so we really had a look at it. And my father had the great idea of putting Hemingway in the piece.
In the stage version that's about to be, you know, seen in Pittsburgh, Hemingway is writing the story at a desk as it's happening. And let's remind people, this is Santiago, this poor Job-like fisherman. When he finally does haul in this huge marlin, his catch, it's eaten by sharks.
You understand that this book has become such a treasure. It's really a great example of how one man's devotion to the cause of his life, which is the sea, is everybody's devotion to some cause. This old man and his attitude and his achievement, and yet he falls short. But in a way, that touches the course of everyone's life. That's really what goes on the stage.
It was also, you know, it had been 11 years since Hemingway wrote For Whom the Bell Tolls, and he had a lot to prove at this time in his career as well.
He had previously, not very long before, written a novel called Across the River and Into the Trees. And for the first time in his long writing life, that book had been roundly assaulted by the critics, the sharks. So now he has organized himself to write a rebuttal. An Old Man in the Sea is Hemingway, the old man, getting back at the elements that have attacked his virtuosity.
But he fought back against that. He said, this is an old man. The sharks are just sharks. All the symbolism that people say is blank word. Tim, what do you think is true?
I do think he had a lot to prove. He was very competitive. But I also think this made him kind of reexamine his masculinity, his machismo, this kind of idea of that we go out and we kill, you know, what lives in the sea, or are they our brothers? And kind of this idea of fallibility and infallibility and something that we wrestle with now so much.
Hemingway said of the manuscript when he sent it to his editor, I know that it's the best I can write ever for all of my life, I think. He added he hoped it would get rid of the school of criticism, that I'm through as a writer, because that was the talk. But I just have to ask you, Hotch, nothing was ever enough. And, you know, we know Hemingway killed himself, put a gun in his mouth.
Well, Hemingway, and we had many adventures together, bullfighting, fishing, but he was not the braggadocio, knock down the opposition men that has sort of endured over the years. He was really much more introspective, much quieter. He was belligerent, and he was tough, and he liked prize fighting, but that was not the overriding menace of his personality.
The drinking, of course, was legendary, and it said that the Hemingway's drinking eroded his writing. And it was when he realized he couldn't write anymore that he became just run down. Tim, you and your father, in the stage version, though, capture a Hemingway at his, you know, at his best. How do you do that? It is, after all, someone writing.
So once we started to kind of play with that reimagining it and that dichotomy, we kind of started to think Hemingway can move around. Mm-hmm. He can be a part of not just the narration, but a part of the exploration to actually bring out what I think Mr. Hemingway was getting at with a lot of the character traits, especially of Santiago. He's a moving, living, breathing character. And again, this is, I think, Hemingway's most sensitive piece in terms of nature and our relationship to the environment and the sun and the moon and the stars and all these things that these days we seem to want to kind of conquer. And Hemingway was saying, let's just sit back and behold some of these.
Hotch, I guess I wonder too, what do you think Hemingway would think of what actually, come to think of it, is your Marlin? You have brought in the Marlin. You've done it. You know, it took, 60 odd years. You're 101. You reeled this in.
It's very hard to know. I think that he would applaud the fact that we didn't put the book on a pedestal and just replicate it, but that instead we tried. Whether we succeed or not is up to the audience and the people who see it.
Well, you fulfilled a promise.
Well, I did. And it did bother me for a lot of years that tossing it around my mind, I couldn't find a way to get it away from its literary self into its dramatic self.
Right, and to just see my old man kind of and his perseverance and his kind of going back after the Marlin repeatedly. Mm. I mean, he's always said that's what's gotten him to 101, just that we can be destroyed, but we can't be defeated. I guess it's just incredible it's taken so long for us to do something together, but it's really, really a beautiful thing.
Oh, well, you're very lucky.
Yes.
That's Tim Hotchner, his dad, the Hemingway friend and biographer A.E. Hotchner. Together they've adapted The Old Man and the Sea for the stage. It opens at the Pittsburgh Playhouse. We will have more information at herenow.org. Tim Hotch, congratulations, and thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you.
Very nice of you to have us.
And you're listening to Here and Now.
Trade talks between the U.S. and China continue in Washington today. President Trump tweeted this morning that while the negotiations are going well, no deal will be final until he sits down with the Chinese President Xi Jinping in the near future. He called Xi his friend. Time is of the essence, as both sides are eager to avoid an automatic 25% tariff hike, which is set to go into effect on March the 2nd. For more, let's bring in Robin Farzad, host of Full Disclosure. Hi, Robin.
How are you, Jeremy?
Doing well. So what do we know about the talks, and are they going well, as the president says?
Progress by the centimeter, it would seem. I mean, these empires and their emperors, let's be honest, they still fall apart. They're far apart. China's economy czar is here offering some modest concessions, but not enough to kind of push us to a breakthrough.
And it looks like China is willing to meet the U.S. on one demand, which was to purchase more American goods, such as tractors and soybeans. How significant is that?
Yeah, these are like kind of like peace offerings you take to a medieval castle. The king gives it a look, goes, meh, and sends you back on a 5-week horse ride to come back for more. If you're that courier, ideally you don't get your head chopped off.
What are the other issues that are still outstanding?
Yeah, Washington wants deep cuts and reforms to what's called China's Great Protectionist Wall. These are the industrial policies that bolster its national champion corporations that are closely controlled by the regime in Beijing. And you think about the otherwise secret intellectual property and corporate secrets that U.S. multinationals must hand over just to have access to China's consumers and manufacturing facilities. Both Trump's base and more pinkish elements like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce want him to get these huge deep concessions from China and to not back down until something like that happens.
Another thing that's going on in the background here is the sort of war of arrests and charges. And in this case, it's the indictment of Meng Wanzhou, the Huawei executive, who is currently detained in Canada. The U.S. says that Meng Wanzhou violated sanctions against Iran. How is that playing into this?
It's audacious. I mean, it's an escalation, but it also telegraphs to China that this administration is willing to play that kind of hardball. And honestly, it's a negotiating chip in a really tense and tight negotiation between the planet's top two economic powers. So you see carrots, sticks, winks, inducements, and this is yet another chip in that game.
Now, these negotiations have been led by the U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer and the Chinese Vice Premier You He. But President Trump is meeting face-to-face with the Vice Premier today after the talks conclude. What should we be watching for there?
It's all a dry run for when Trump meets with his counterpart, China's head of state. And these two men are intensely mindful of projecting strength, of being able to go home and declare victory. You saw Trump do that with the scrapping of NAFTA. And that wasn't all that all earth-shattering, but nevertheless valuable to him in terms of political and rhetorical deliverables. We'd be in a far different position right now, Jeremy, if the stock market here was falling apart and investors were begging for the U.S. to relent. But I think if you step back, the smart money is betting that these two leaders will privately agree to face-saving concessions that let them return to Washington and China looking effective in the end.
How soon do you think there might be a meeting between the two of them?
I predict that it happens by, let's say, March 20th. February 20th. March 2 is the guillotine come-down date where these sanctions are supposed to ratchet up. And the base here really wants it, and China is terrified of it. And that's the leverage that you see in between.
Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure, thank you.
My pleasure.
Anti-Semitic incidents are on the rise worldwide. This week, a Toledo area man was indicted for what officials said was a planned attack on a synagogue. Well, Hilda Schramm must be watching nervously because she knows where this leads. She's a former president of the Green Party in Germany, but more to the point, she's the now 82-year-old daughter of Albert Speer, Hitler's war production minister. After he died, she inherited paintings from him. They weren't stolen art, but she decided to sell them and start a foundation, the Zurich Gaben Foundation, to turn artwork or anything gained by Germans during this terrible chapter in history into financial support for Jewish female artists in Germany. And she also started a movement to get all Germans to recognize that they all probably gained from the Jews' terrible losses. Her charitable work recently won her an Obermeyer German Jewish History Award presented in Berlin's parliament. It pays tribute to non-Jewish Germans making outstanding contributions to preserving the memory of Jewish communities. And Hilda Schramm joins us from her home in Berlin. Hilda, welcome and congratulations on the award.
Well, thank you very much. I'm very happy to have gotten it.
Yeah. You're 82 now, and you've been quoted as saying, "When do I get to be known for what I've done and not for being Albert Speer's daughter?" But the work that you're doing will always remind people, you know, that you are Albert Speer's daughter. You know, how do you square that fact that, you know, it feels as if your work is directly connected?
Most people in Germany know that I'm the daughter of Albert Speer, but sooner or later, it is not so important anymore. Mm-hmm. There are many, many others in my generation who have had fathers or mothers or grandparents who were highly involved in the NS regime. So it's not something so special as you may think here in Germany.
Yeah. Well, but that's one of your points, is to remind Germans that there may have been, you know, people who worked directly with Hitler, people who served in the military. But every time a Jew lost a job because they were sent away, and we know terrible things that happened when they were sent away, that a German family might have taken that job. I mean, it seems as if part of what you are gently telling your fellow countrymen, reminding them, is that, you know, many people benefited.
Very many people really benefited in very different ways. Some went to auctions where they could buy very cheap the household objects and the clothes and everything the Jews had owned. And others, as you already mentioned, stepped into jobs that were empty because all Jews were expelled. Then other cases were in a village. There perhaps were three stores who sold the same stuff. And then one had to give up his store. And of course, the other two, without their willingness, they took advantage that there were one less to offer the same, let's say, clothes. So sometimes it is willingly done. Sometimes it's really structurally done. Sometimes it is without intention, but still they did profit, even if they took goods from a Jewish family as they were asked to take it and would agree to give it back when they would come back, but they didn't come back.
Well, so I'm wondering, your foundation, Zurich Gaben Foundation, that means to give back. Is that what you're saying to people, that you want them to, you know, give back?
Mostly they don't bring it back. if there is a possibility to find out to whom it did belong and if they are descendants, they, with our help or without our help, would, of course, try to give it back to directly to the former owner. In most cases, it cannot be given back. There are many ways to handle the situation. I myself think the best way is to keep it in the household, in the family, and treasure it, because the object has an history, and to keep the remembrance of the whole story in the family tradition. But still, they can give donation with the amount they decide themselves. It may have nothing to do with the value of the object, which may be almost without any value if you count it on money, but it has emotional value. Mm.
Well, and this is how this all started, because you decided to sell the paintings that you inherited from your father. And I want to remind people, your father, Albert Speer, went on trial, the infamous Nuremberg trials, the only Nazi to apologize, but he claimed never to know about the Holocaust itself. What do you think about that claim?
Well, I'm sure he didn't want to know very deeply. He didn't want to know, but I think he must have known. Yeah, I think he must have known.
Mm-hmm. What kind of a burden is that for a child?
When you are a child, you take it all natural. You don't think much about it. My father was kind and friendly. When I became older, I knew that he was imprisoned, and I knew for what reason. And so I was forced to think about his participation or leading function. So I had to work it out and get an attitude towards it, and also try to make my own and very different living, always on the background of knowing what happened in my own family.
Do I understand that as a child you were with your father once and actually met Hitler?
Yes, certainly I met Hitler, but I don't remember it. I saw it on the pictures later on television, but yeah. I don't remember it myself. Yeah. Perhaps I don't want to remember it.
I mean, how much did that shape you?
I tried to find my own way. That was what I wanted to do, and I got good influences. Like, I was fortunate to be sent to the United States for 1 year. And I met other people later. I had a Jewish teacher later in history. She was a very remarkable woman. Later I wrote a book about her to find out how she survived and what she did. So you are not alone. You grow up in a community. So I didn't feel so exceptional.
When you say you want to be part of a community, we understand you live in a very big house with people who just may need some space, and you invite them in, including recently Syrian refugees. Your works have been so good, with a capital G, trying to fund Jewish female artists, trying to raise awareness of other Germans, bringing in refugees. Is it a part of trying to overcome that family history?
Certainly. My husband and me and others, we didn't want to live how our parents had lived. We wanted to be open-minded, have an open house, help other people. I'm living in a house community. I've lived here since my children were born, that because I wanted to have them grow up with other children.
I have to ask, what do you tell your children about their grandfather, who, by the way, served 20 years, died in 1981? How do you tell a child that?
I told them the truth slowly and cautiously, and then later my children met my father, and so for them it was difficult to understand, as it is for me all the time still, that such a friendly man could have been not only affiliated but have a leading position in this horrible government, which killed so awfully many people.
I can't even, I mean, I'm trying to wrap my brain around, as you say, trying to understand. And here we are, I mean, in the United States in 2017, there was a 57% increase in anti-Semitic incidents. We know there's been an increase across Europe, and also a rise of the right across Europe. Is there anything that you have come to understand about your father that people can maybe learn from? I mean, how it is that somebody walks lockstep into this horror?
Of course, I try to reflect. And I think he was awfully ambitious. And this is part of it. He wanted to have power. At least I was more cautious in my life, not to get into a situation where I don't look right and left anymore, but just be ambitious and work and work and be effective. So it's not only anti-Semitism, it's a complete lack of empathy. And that's exactly what not only me, but I hope the majority of our society tries to avoid.
That's Hilde Schramm, recently awarded the Obermeyer German Jewish History Award by Open the Circle. Their mission is to build a tolerant future through a shared understanding of the past. We'll link you to it at herenow.org. Hilde, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Imagine, her father, Albert Speer.
With the polar vortex bringing near record low temperatures to the Midwest this week, scientists have tied this extreme weather to the overall trend of a warming planet. That scientific consensus hasn't convinced President Trump. However, he tweeted his skepticism this week, asking global warming to come back fast. We need you. Media organizations have debated how to cover the facts of climate change for decades, but that debate has been playing out again this week. And joining us to talk about that is NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. Hi, David.
Hey, Jeremy.
Well, media organizations, including NPR, have pointed out the connection between the polar vortex in the Midwest and climate change. I noticed on a network news show, which are often criticized for not making that connection to climate change, on CBS This Morning this week, they did the same. Let's listen.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, January 30th, 2019. Welcome to CBS This Morning. Historic frigid weather makes parts of the upper Midwest feel like it's 60 below. Cities make intense efforts to get their most vulnerable people out of the deadly cold. We'll show you what's behind the winter blast and the role of climate change.
Okay, there it is. David, how have news organizations evolved in connecting these extreme weather stories to the overall trend of climate change?
Well, John Dickerson, whom you heard there, and CBS This Morning are no fools in acknowledging that role. You've seen their sort of increasing efforts by scientists and some journalists with specialty in the area to incorporate that as the science seems to be clearer about not just the fact that that man-made emissions and carbon and the warming of the environment are present and having an effect, but that you can start to make a connection to individual events. And so you're starting to see that. That is a change. You used to see particularly meteorologists on TVs, especially local but also national TV, really resist talking about climate. They're going to say, we're talking about weather. Climate is global. Climate is a whole different layer there. It's too unpredictable. Heck, we have trouble predicting more than 10 days out. And what you've seen is sort of a joining of meteorology and climate science to say, yeah, these things are interconnected in a real way. And therefore, you can start to see this in all kinds of coverage from local TV to, you know, national newspapers.
And then there is Brian Kilmeade here on Fox and Friends on Fox News. Listen.
You know, it was true that the climate change became climate change when global warming wasn't adding up to global warming. It was going very cold. And then people say with the temperature went up a couple of degrees, they go, we'll change it. We're going to start using climate change. So anytime there's a tornado, a typhoon, a flood, what did I tell you? And then there hence starts the debate.
David, what about that? Have we got past that where we can recognize that global warming is the overall trend, even if it means severe winter storms?
What climate change really means is there's global warming and the atmosphere is warming and all kinds of other things are warming. And at the same time, it's calling all kinds of weather disruption and spikes and variables in all directions. You know, the real thing is in some ways that climate change became very much part of the political vernacular in the 1990s, in part as a result of Newt Gingrich, the Congress that came to power in 1995 in opposition to the Clinton White House, wanted to call it something that seemed less threatening than global warming, and they focus group tested the phrase climate change, and it seemed less threatening to people at a time they were trying to hold down certain kinds of regulation.
So what are the media to do when President Trump tweets out, you know, global warming, come back fast, we need you? Is it the media's responsibility to then do a whole fact-checking session about that, or do they just let it go?
You know, I don't think the media has to, in every element, go after the individual tweet. I do think it's not fair simply to say, you know, The president, without any evidence, says, you know, there's no such thing as global warming. I think that the media and reporters and journalists need to perform a civic and educational function of the public to say this is what the science shows and incorporate that into its main coverage and not simply just hive that off into fact-checking columns as useful as those can be for enduring correctives online. I think that the media has to be front and center and confident about reporting what it knows, make sure to contextualize it, making sure not to overstate what the science says, but to say, you know, it is appears increasingly certain that such severe weather spikes of winter chill or of summer heat appear to be increasingly likely, as are more tornadoes and hurricanes and the like as a result of climate change. And I think that's journalistically valid and important thing to do for the public so they can make the choices that affect their own lives.
We produced this show in association with the BBC World Service, and the BBC told staff last year not to include outright deniers of climate change in BBC coverage in the same way you would not have someone denying that Manchester United won 2-0 last Saturday.
Yep.
How common is that in newsrooms right now to send out a message from the top saying, here's how we're going to do it?
Well, in some ways, the Beeb, while one of the world's great news organizations, is a little late to the party. It's been a few years since even cable channels in this country, by and large, have been willing to put on climate change denialists, shall we say, people who reject the science just on the basis of what's convenient for them ideologically. And the BBC, which has a statutory mandate of even-handedness, was overcompensating. That is, you know, if 1.5% of scientists or so believe that you can't really attribute climate change to man-made emissions or the like, it's not fair to balance that out one-on-one with somebody who believes that is the case, even if that represents 98% of scientists. And you saw that in things in Britain over the question of the debate about the economic effects of Brexit. You've seen it in this country on certain things. We've had to work out the fact that this oppositional debate in which we stage a lot of our journalism through argumentation doesn't work when the science is so clearly on one side.
NPR Media Correspondent David Folkenflik, thank you.
You bet.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.